rock and roll culture is so male dominated, and it also seems to be dominated by sort of a hostility against women, you know, that this sort of sexual identity that is sort of used as a weapon against the populace, you know, and women in particular, and then everyone identifies with it.
Pioneering singer Linda Ronstadt, that clip featured in a new documentary called Linda Ronstadt, The Sound of My Voice. My interview with the filmmaker is about her legacy coming up later in the show. But first, David Crosby wrote and or sang many of the songs we associate with the golden age of American rock music.
To everything, turn, turn, turn. There is a season, turn, turn, turn. And a time to every purpose under heaven.
As a founding member of the Byrds, Crosby was a devotee of harmonies. Well, that band famously fired him. Then he formed rock's first supergroup, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and later Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young. With CSN and CSNY, Crosby helped shape the sound of a generation.
Our house is a very, very, very fine house with two cats in the yard. Life used to be so hard. Now everything is easy 'cause of you.
Well, Crosby's life certainly hasn't been easy. He has had friends who died young, fractured relationships with his bandmates, famously drug addicted, a stint in a Texas state prison, and now he has some major health problems. But at the age of 77, he's still performing. He's still touring. His story is told now in a new documentary produced by Cameron Crowe, whom he first met in the early 1970s when Crowe was a teenage rock journalist. It's called David Crosby, Remember My Name. I spoke with him and Cameron Crowe earlier. Welcome to Press Play, both of you. Nice to have you in the studio.
A pleasure.
Nice to see you.
You too.
Especially nice to see you here, looking healthy and alive and happy.
Thank you, darling.
All right. Well, tell us that you two have had a very long relationship.
Indeed.
Like 45 years or so?
Getting longer every day.
Yeah.
And it's good. It's good.
And you met when you were, what, 17?
16.
16.
Yeah.
I thought it was 15. I've been saying 50. Okay, yeah.
And what happened? Tell us about that.
I had wanted to interview Cross for a while, but he being kind of shrouded in the mystique of CSNY and protected by their manager Elliot Roberts, you couldn't get near them. They would be like one of those guys would be in one of your kind of areas where you're interviewing another artist like Jackson Browne or somebody, and David would be there or Stephen Stills or something, and the vibe would be like don't go there.
Why don't they
don't do interviews. And it's like the American Beatles, you know, don't talk to them.
And what would have happened? They would have just yelled at you?
I don't know, because they weren't doing interviews.
Why weren't you doing interviews?
We were.
Oh.
It was total bull.
Oh, okay.
Somebody told him that just to try and manipulate
him. Well, you had interviewed with Ben Fong-Torres, I know, but that was a famous interview, but nobody kind of in any recent time had gotten to David Crosby. So my dream was like one day I could actually talk to them or him. So I was a huge fan. And then in 1974, I had an assignment from a magazine called Crawdaddy. But I don't think when he approved me to come interview him that he even knew what my assignment was for. He just was honest with me. And I had a million questions. He made me feel like a compatriot, just talking to me like, you know, artist to artist. And I'm 16. You know, I walked out of that room thinking this is what I want to do. I want to interview and like follow my dream of honoring the art I loved.
And it
all kind of began then.
And that's what you did. So at the time, who were you?
Oh, boy, is that a complex question.
That's a really good question.
At the time, I was kind of a pain in the butt. We were huge. And that's never good for you.
What year is this? By the way,
74.
Can't tell you.
74.
He knows. I have no idea. You know, like,
so you're a super group at this point.
Yeah,
you're...
at that point. The thing about Cameron, when he showed up, he was the brightest kid any of us had ever met. Now you can ask anybody in the Almonds or the Zap or anybody. We all have felt the same way. Everybody, when you encountered him, he was the smartest kid you ever met, and he was nice.
But at the time, did you see yourself as like a demigod?
No. You know, I'm not sure. Maybe it's because I was brought up in show business. My dad was a cinematographer, made films, and I've kind of seen how that all works my whole life, and I don't buy it. I don't buy star. I don't buy celebrity. I don't buy fame at all. It's not
part of my
world.
But you bought into the whole rock and roll lifestyle.
I bought into that lifestyle because I was stoned and happy and looking, you know, I was trying to follow every girl in the world, all of you. Every female on
the planet. Wasn't every rock and roll guy doing that?
Kind of like, yeah. That was sort of our MO, you know. But you try to do it without harming people, and sometimes you do harm people.
And you're very candid in the interviews in the documentary about that very issue, that you've harmed a lot of people.
Well, here's the thing about documentaries. They're normally shine jobs. You know that. Mm-hmm. They're normally... Oh, golly, you know, then I invented Eternal Life, and right after that I found Great Peace, and aren't I cute? And it's just bull. It has nothing to do with the truth of the matter. If I wanted to see a documentary about you personally, I want to know
I think it'd be kind of boring.
It wouldn't be, because I wouldn't do that. I'd find out what you care about. I'd find out what you're afraid of. I'd find out who you love, and it would be very interesting. It would be fascinating, because
absolutely,
I wouldn't go for the shallow stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It ain't about what you look like in high heels. It's about what's behind your eyes. And that's where he goes. And he's a good filmmaker. And AJ's a really good filmmaker.
This is the director.
AJ Eaton. Yeah.
They are uncompromisingly committed to being good artists. And I think they did a great job.
What did you want to find out about him that you didn't know already?
I was sitting here wanting to ask him a question a minute ago. I just love talking with him. He's just a great storyteller, and he listens to you. He's present. And I think I am going to ask him this question in a second on your time.
Sorry.
But I agree so much with what you're saying about documentaries, Cross, because I was thinking, you know what they really are mostly right now? Advertisements.
Mm-hmm.
They're an advertisement to get in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, love me, remember me, get me in the Hall of Fame, or to sell a tour or an album. And we're not doing that. He's already in the Hall of Fame twice.
And they're generally very self-serving and very shallow and very self-congratulatory and not at all honest.
But, okay, so first of all, what is your question?
You know, you were just talking about, like, you chased all the women. You were very interested in the women. And watching the documentary, we talk about that. But I was wondering if the pursuit of women was part of scratch me behind my ear and make me feel like I'm loved and wanted, which he talks about in the movie, right? So I'm just wondering, is that an extension of that scratch me behind my ear?
You are such a sneaky guy.
Why didn't you ask this on camera?
Yeah, because there's a lot of that. You know, we could make another one. I'm telling you, everybody that's seen the documentary, that's one of the first things they say. First thing they say is it's great, it's honest. Second thing is, you know, you could have included...
Yeah.
They always
have
a list.
Right. What about the liver transplant?
Okay.
Where was that?
So what about that?
Unquestionably, I'm always looking for approval.
Yeah.
From you, from all of my friends, and definitely from any woman that I'm interested in. I'm trying to show off. I'm Leo, and so I'll like preen, you know, and can I say, do you think I'm cool? Am I really magnificent? Do you like my mane? and they're either they're patient with that or they have no time for it and move on.
but you also honor the women that you've been with, that I've seen that.
Oh, man. They've been wonderful to me. And the ones that I lived with and was with for a long periods of time, they were wonderful, wonderful women, and they loved me better than I managed to love them. And I'm very grateful for the time I spent with every single one of them.
So much of it's in the music, too.
Yeah.
And
these were long-term relationships. These lasted years. These were not, you know.
The woman you're married to now.
All the other ones.
This
too.
Is the secret sauce of the documentary, is the love story with Jan.
Yeah.
And
when
that kind of revealed itself as we were making the film, it was like, okay, there it is.
She's very raw at the end of that movie.
It's beautiful.
She's very truthful, and she's very emotional, and she is not kidding, and she will tell you what she's actually thinking. We've been together 42 years.
Are you surprised she stayed with you?
Yes, I am. And I'm very grateful. She's the best friend I've ever had.
She does say at the end of the movie, she doesn't know what she'll do if you die before her.
Yeah, well, we both feel that way. You know, when you are linked up for this long, yeah, that's a precipice you don't really want to walk near. But it's part of life. I hope we go together, because I don't want to exist without her either. After 40 years, that's kind of how it is.
And you have children with her?
Oh, yeah, our son Django.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, what a wonderful guy. Yeah, I have several really wonderful children.
I want to go back in time and talk about your relationship with Joni Mitchell.
Okay.
You were with her for how long?
About a year.
Just a year. But that was a very intense relationship.
You know Joni. What do you think?
Well, I don't know her personally. I know her music.
Okay, well, you know the music.
I can understand through the music.
A person's music is a very good window into their soul. And in Joni's case, it's a brilliant window.
Does she talk about you in any of her songs?
Yes.
Which one?
Dawn Treader was her hello, and that song about the midway was her goodbye, and I hope you fall off the edge of the cliff song. And there are probably a couple others in there.
How about Cactus Tree?
Yeah, I think I'm in there too.
There's a man who's been out sailing.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
There you go.
See how much fun this is? He throws no question back at you.
Exactly.
It's like you were with Joni?
Yeah.
Yeah. Were you always this open, or have you learned to be this open? And
I've
disarming?
Learned to be this open. I spent 14 years going to those 12-step meetings.
Uh-huh.
And they have a very low bull quotient in those meetings. And it teaches you, you know, the value of trying to be straight in your answers.
So you were with Joni, and this is all part of that Laurel Canyon scene, which has gotten a lot of attention of late.
Yeah.
And as this, I don't know, is it more myth than fact?
More definitely more myth than fact.
Okay.
We went up there because it was above the smog.
To live and to...
Absolutely. Trees, grass, greenery, little tiny houses, and right. Above the smog line.
Right. It was pretty smoggy back in the 70s. I remember
no
that.
Kidding. Yeah, no, we were up there, and then, you know, the natural thing happened. I moved up there, and then Cass moved up there, and then...
Mama Cass from the
Mamas and Papas. Oh, man, one of my best friends ever in my life. A joy of a human being. And
who died very young.
Well, so did a lot of people, all the same way. I don't know why I didn't.
But you were all doing drugs together.
Yeah, in that case, heroin, yeah.
And no explanation why you are here and they're not.
No, frankly, unless there's a God, in which case she has a sense of humor.
I like that you said funny. She.
That's yeah, funny. I do too. Don't you think that would be really kind and wonderful? What a delightful turn of events that would be.
And what would she say to you?
She'd tell me to behave myself. She'd tell me to...
You David, squeaked by.
Behave yourself. Pay attention and behave yourself.
Back to that. A lot of people did drugs back then, obviously. Some people made it, some people didn't.
He said the other night that he thought cigarettes, the fact that he never smoked cigarettes, was a key factor in having his voice and still being healthy enough to be here.
Yeah.
So interesting.
Really?
Yeah.
You have had many heart attacks.
A couple, yeah. And that's different. That's just kind of a natural thing in the DNA and having mm-hmm. not eaten well, you know, forever.
Not because of all the drugs.
No, that has nothing to do with that.
Cocaine, heroin.
No.
Alcohol.
No, yeah. Would you like to make the list longer? We want to elucidate
you
your list?
Go ahead.
No, honey, I'm just... I didn't want you to enjoy it too much.
I am enjoying this.
So, no, it had nothing to do with that. It has to do with, you know, DNA and diet, usually, mm-hmm. almost always mm-hmm. in heart disease. But you can change it. I have changed it. I've lost 60 pounds, which has made a big improvement in my health.
And so cigarettes, you think, is that also
cigarettes
key?
Are deadly for
but
everything.
But you do really, smoke really weed. Bad.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I don't smoke it. I vaporize it. So
how does that affect your songwriting, your musical
quite positively. Smoking pot's like, it's, you know, it's not that strong. It's like sort of beer or wine, but it is conducive to music for some reason. There's a resonant harmonic there. I commonly at night, you know, we have dinner together, family, and then we
go on. You, Jan, and Django?
Yeah. And then we have a big fireplace that we built. Django and I gathered the rocks to make this big rock fireplace in our bedroom. And we go in there, and Django goes in games, and I build a fire. And then I take a guitar off the wall, and then I smoke a joint. Then, yeah, I get hung up, as the hippie phrase goes.
Does that mean high?
No, it means hung up. It means you're enjoying what you're doing so much that you can't stop doing it.
I see. You're sort of in the zone.
Yeah, I start playing guitar in some weird tuning, and I get hung up. I get into the incredible sound the guitar is making and how joyous it is that my hands will do that. And wow, look at what that happened. Wow, I didn't know it was in there. I've been playing in this tuning for 10 years. I never heard that sound. Oh my God. And I find stuff and I have a blast.
It's still.
Still, and to this day.
Here's what makes it kind of interactive is that his fans, particularly the hardcore fans, join him in that process. They're there when they hear the music, knowing that's how he might have created the music, and they're there to receive the music similarly. In other words, they're stoner, like huge stoner fans that appreciate the no middleman experience.
Yeah.
And when I first met David, part of the legend was that he had the best weed of anybody in the entire rock community. The whole thing was like Crosby weed.
It was true.
It was legend.
I'll tell you a funny story. Linda, great singer, Linda.
Ronstadt.
Okay, she came over. She said, can I come get some pot? And I said, yeah, absolutely, come on. She comes over, and I rolled her like four joints. She takes me, she gives me a big old kiss, runs away. Calls me a half hour later, said, did you put acid in those joints? I said, no, honey, that's just really good pot.
And so the legend.
So the legend looms larger, yeah.
The Linda Ronstadt documentary people are going to be in here asking you to tell that story again. It's just.
I'll tell you, I saw her. I had dinner with her not long ago. And you know, she's got Parkinson's.
Yeah.
And it's just so unfair. And the one thing that could help her is weed. It actually works for Parkinson's really well. And she can't do it. She's allergic. Isn't that that's just awful. And because she's a really...
God isn't a woman then.
Well, you know, because man, they should cut
her
some slack.
She'd be a little bit more merciful.
That woman has shed a lot of light. She is one of the best singers I ever sung with in my life.
She's amazing.
Ever. Mm-hmm. And a really good human being.
You guys, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
So fun.
Let's do it again.
Let's do it.
Fun.
Definitely.
I'd talk to you anytime.
Okay. You're welcome anytime. It's David Crosby and also Cameron Crowe. Check out the new documentary, David Crosby, Remember My Name.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I feel so bad. I got a worried mind. I'm so lonesome all the time. Since I left my baby behind on Blue Bayou.
Coming up, well, Cameron Crowe called it. The Linda Ronstadt documentary people were in here. The directors of Linda Ronstadt, The Sound of My Voice, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. That is, of course, Linda Ronstadt, the original female rock star. She sang rock, she sang folk, she sang Mexican mariachi and operetta. Well, Linda Ronstadt did it all, and she won 10 Grammys. She was the only female artist with 5 platinum-selling albums in a row. But she hasn't sung in public for 10 years. She lost her ability to sing because of Parkinson's disease. A new documentary looks back at her career. It's called Linda Ronstadt, The Sound of My Voice, directed by Rob Epstein and Jeffrey Friedman, who joined me now in the studio. Hi.
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 Well, nice to see you. So she started out in the late 60s, early 70s in Los Angeles and found her way to the famed, I guess, Laurel Canyon folk scene, right? Mm-hmm. And how did she break out? How did she, because there were a lot of young people singing folk music at that time. What distinguished her?
Her voice, Different Drum, her first hit single. First record I ever bought was a 45 of Different Drum. And certainly that voice was unlike anything I had heard on the radio before. And now also when you look at the lyrics of that song, Different Drum, that song was written by a man, Michael Nesmith, who went on to form the Monkees, about a man who is not tied down to any one woman. And she flipped that on its head. She turned that on its head. 21 years old, you know, just going out there for the first time. And that was a brave thing to do in retrospect. I mean, now I look at it, it's something we all take for granted, but that really kind of set the stage for who she was and who she would become.
And it must have been difficult back then to be a female fronting rock band, like have all her musicians be men, and she was out in front as the leader of the band.
Yeah, she was a trailblazer in that regard. And she talks about it now that, yes, it was tough, but really the band members were on board because she was a strong musician. And ultimately, that's what made it all work, that they had faith in her as a singer. So she was able to front and direct this group of guys through most of her career, you know, from one band to another. She was also instrumental in forming the Eagles. Don Henley and Glenn Frey were part of her original backup band, and then they went off to form the Eagles, of course.
Oh, wow. Did she resent them for leaving?
Not at all. She wished them well. And in fact, she recorded Desperado after their first album came out and made a hit for them when she sang it.
Desperado, why don't you come to your senses? You've been out riding fences for so long now. Oh, you're a hard one, but I know that you got your reasons. These things that are pleasing you will hurt you somehow.
But take us back to that time, because at that time, what, the early 70s, mid 70s, there were a lot of like big dude bands, like the Eagles, for example. And then here she was, singing rock and roll. You know, now we listen to it and we think, oh, that's no big deal for a woman to sing rock and roll. But I guess back then it was a big deal.
Yeah, it was a very male world. It was, in retrospect, it does seem like she was like incredibly brave and brazen to be, you know, in her 20s and fronting bands of male musicians. But, I don't get the sense that it felt that way to her. I think she just wanted to sing and make music.
You know, the paradox of Linda being on stage in front of this, you know, this group of guys alone as the lead singer, she had tremendous insecurity about her voice and about being on stage. She never set out to create any kind of persona. She was just always just about her own personhood. And part of that personhood was her sense of insecurity about her own talent and abilities. But that also fueled her. That also gave her a kind of drive to go out there and do it and conquer her own insecurities.
And she sang loud.
Mm-hmm.
And
She sang loud, and she also, now she talks about it, she said she was singing loud at a time where there were no monitors. So she had no idea how loud she was singing in relationship to anything else, because there was no feedback.
Well, she never thought she was singing loud enough.
Right.
So that's why she was belting it out?
And that's why I kept getting louder, I think. Yeah.
And did she like playing the big stadium crowds?
No, she didn't like it. She says she didn't know why all those people were there. She just wanted to sing. And, you know, singing in stadiums is not optimum because the acoustics are terrible. And I just think it's really hard to connect to an audience.
Well, she talks about that, how when you're singing in a stadium, there's no focal point for you to look at. You know, you're just in this massive environment and there's no real connection to the audience. For her, she was just a singer on stage in this vast arena and felt like she was just singing into a void. Hmm. So that's when she really made the turn and decided she wanted to be in more theatrical settings where she knew her place on the stage in relationship to the audience. And that sort of drove her to make the shift to doing Broadway initially when she did the operetta Pirates of Penzance, and then on to do the standards, and then on to do the canciones.
Can you compare her to the other female singers of the day? Compare their voices. What made her this, you know, incredible talent? Not to say that these other women weren't, but she had something in her voice that most women, most singers, do not have.
I don't know if I can comment on the quality of that. I think the fact is the range of materials. Dolly Parton says in the film, she can sing opera. I couldn't do all that. You know, Linda can sing anything. And I think when you look at her relative to her peers, that's the factual evidence, is that she has this incredible range.
Now, she was good friends with Dolly Parton and Emmylou Harris. They performed together. And initially, you don't think that musically they're in the same category, but I guess since Linda can sing anything, they are. And they formed kind of a female power trio, right?
Trio was revolutionary.
Well, I think there wasn't a women's group that were working in harmony like Crosby, Stills, and Nash. I think they were really the female equivalent of Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and that was new. Mm-hmm. I don't think a group had come together in that way.
And Linda was very supportive of her female peers. You know, it was a small group of women who were making it in the industry at that time, and they all knew each other and they supported each other. And that was a kind of a beautiful thing.
Bury me.
Dolly Parton, Emmylou Harris, and of course Linda Ronstadt there.
Mm-hmm. And that's also Linda, in a way, coming back to her own roots and sense of self, because she always considered herself a harmony singer. She never really thought of herself as a lead singer. She was, her first singing experiences were singing harmony with her siblings and her family. So this was very a real place of home for her.
And along the way, she famously hooked up with Governor Jerry Brown during his first tenure as governor.
He was running for president.
Yeah, right. And so that was quite an interesting couple. I guess a power couple. But she is pretty political. And is that one of the reasons why they were attracted to each other?
Who knows?
One can deduce that's true. Linda was always very outspoken about her political beliefs. And I'm sure that's something that Jerry Brown found intoxicating. But Linda has never been one to hold back about whatever issues she's concerned with at the moment. And that's true to this day, even with her Parkinson's, which limits her physically in terms of what she can do in the world. She's completely engaged with the world and the state of the world. And you can get her going on any topic and she'll have an opinion about it.
Let me play a snippet from your movie when she was on a show called The Don Lane Show. And I guess this was in the 80s. Because they're talking about South Africa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, because this is during the apartheid era.
Now, you went to South Africa recently. Did you receive criticism for going there?
As far as I was concerned, it was just a gig. I don't think that if you disagree with the policies of the government, which I do very definitely disagree with the policies of the South African government, I don't think that's enough of a reason not to go and play music there. If I did that, I wouldn't be able to play in the United States because I don't agree with their policies about nuclear power or nuclear warfare. I mean, my God, we've got this person running the country, you know, that I completely disagree with. If I decided that I wasn't going to play where attitudes of racism prevailed, I certainly couldn't play in Australia or England or lots of places in the United States, a lot of places in the American South, or Boston, which is extremely racist.
She could have gone on and on.
How does she talk like that? She's just so articulate.
But it was just off the top of her head that she was talking like that. So when she was on the road, I don't know, was she reading all sorts of political books and keeping up with the news?
She reads all the time. She's always reading. She always has a book. When she was playing those big stadiums, she'd be in her dressing room reading a book before she went on stage. I think maybe that was a way of relaxing. She always kept up with current events and had strong opinions about them and was never shy about sharing them. She very much sees what's going on in literature and in current events and politics. And I think that's what really interests her, aside from music. Music is the primary interest.
So a tragedy then for her that this disease has robbed her of the ability to sing.
Yes.
The last time she sang was 10 years ago?
Yeah.
Yeah. Last time she sang in public, yeah.
And the disease just makes her vocal cords.
Well, she loses. She doesn't have control over them. Mm-hmm. It's just she doesn't get the message. Doesn't get from the brain to the vocal cords. And it took a long time for her to get the diagnosis. She knew that there was something going on with her voice, that she didn't have the control that she had, but she didn't know what was going on until a couple of years after she noticed that, and you know, it got to the point where she didn't feel it was fair to charge people admission to hear her. She describes it as screaming on stage. I'm sure it was prettier than that, but you know, I mean, somebody that has that kind of beauty and control of her instrument, when the instrument starts to get away from her, you know, I can imagine it would be unsatisfying for her as well as for her fans.
Yeah, and she lives in San Francisco.
She does.
And so how does she enjoy music today?
She loves music. She keeps up with current musical trends. She told us about some South Korean gender fluid punk band that she found on the internet somewhere.
Sing Sing? Or
Sing
something.
Sing, yeah, with two S's in each sing. So she's very engaged with music, and I think it's still her first love.
And one of the final conversations that we had with her that we were recording for the voiceover, because Linda narrates the film, she's essentially telling her own story. When we asked her that question, she said she can still sing in her mind, which is just such a beautiful notion. And that gives her a kind of solace.
That's Rob Epstein and Jeffrey Friedman, directors of Linda Ronstadt, The Sound of My Voice. The movie is available on Amazon beginning December 3rd. Coming up, we'll find out why the Carpenters are huge in the Philippines.
There's something about what the Carpenters sang about that was this vision of America that certainly had been peddled to us in other aspects of popular culture as post-colonial people in relation to the U.S.
We've only just begun. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Walking around, some kind of lonely cloud. Rainy days and Mondays always get me down.
Well, rain or not, we are not down because we are going to listen back to my interview about the legacy of the Carpenters. Well, one Carpenter, Karen, and how she has played a central role in the life of Karen Tongson. Not only was Tongson named after Karen Carpenter, but the Carpenters were central to Tongson's culture growing up in the Philippines. The Carpenters are icons over there. They're played all over the country to this day. Karen Tongson teaches English at USC. She wrote a book called Why Karen Carpenter Matters. And when I spoke with her a few months ago, I began by asking her why her parents named her after Karen Carpenter.
I assume it's because she herself was a singer, and she also happened to be young. She was 18 when she had me. So an 18-year-old in 1973, especially in the Philippines, is prone to being a Carpenters fan. And I think that that fandom and the fact that her voice was so often compared to Karen Carpenter's really kind of tilted her in that direction. So instead of naming me after herself, it was someone who, I guess, was some kind of spiritual kindred spirit, rather, you know, vocally.
So she had a low voice.
She had a low voice. She still has a low voice, an alto voice.
Yeah, this is an interesting thing about Karen Carpenter is her voice, because they're such sweet songs, or they're described as sweet, like sugary, saccharine songs. And yet her voice is so deep. When there's no
the timbre of her voice, the quality of it, Dionne Warwick described it as the sound of smoking wood. And I think that it's the depth of that voice, the range of that voice, that is the thing that's kind of captured people's imaginations and has been a real enduring thing. And what makes people read sadness into it, even when she's singing very sunny and optimistic music.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Dionne Warwick, Close to You.
Yes.
So she sang that, and Burt Bacharach wrote that for Dionne Warwick, right?
Absolutely.
So she sang it originally. And then the Carpenters did a cover of it, which became their first breakout hit.
Yeah, the song never really did anything when Dionne Warwick recorded it and as a single. It didn't really ascend the charts. It was out in the 60s. And you know, it was ostensibly Richard Carpenter's arrangement, which gave it that frilly little piano lick and some of the other accoutrement that made it such a hit in the 70s.
Let's hear a little bit of Close to You.
Why do stars fall down from the sky every time you walk by?
And she's playing the drums.
She's playing the drums. You know, the thing that a lot of people who aren't Carpenters fans don't know is that Karen began as a drummer. So she wasn't always a vocalist. She was the drummer for Richard's other musical ensembles, like his jazz band, the Dick Carpenter Trio. And somehow through a series of various accidents, probably singing backup, etc., for Richard, they discovered Karen's low voice and they decided to kind of run with it. And they realized it was such a rich and beautiful thing that they could send her as part of their sound.
Now, their sound was kind of not taken seriously, shall we say, here by serious rock critics in the United States.
Yeah. Lester Bangs called them creepy.
Well, he also called them creepy because they were brother and sister and they were marketed as almost like a couple.
Yeah, there was a kind of vagueness to and a lack of understanding as how to like kind of promote a family act that was, you know, a brother and sister act. And Richard himself really complained about that quite frequently, that he's like, I can't believe they're like putting us in these romantic poses because we're brother and sister.
Weren't they asked straight up if they were having a relationship?
Yeah, there's one radio DJ, I think from Toronto, if I remember correctly, like really ribbed them and asked them directly if there was anything untoward or taboo that they might be participating in with each other. And I think that that's something that, you know, for people who are supposedly so wholesome and, you know, kind of square, they were often addressing a kind of salacious range of questions in that way and having to engage that.
That's really interesting because they did present as just white bread America. I mean, they're from Downey, which is a white working class community here.
And originally from Connecticut, too. So it's not like they came from a place that was less white and moved to Downey, you know?
And they embodied that sound.
Yeah.
That sound that was considered non-threatening.
The best of young America, in Richard Nixon's words.
Is that how he described
them? That's how he described them, yeah, when they visited the White House.
So non-urban.
Non-urban.
Non-black.
Mm-hmm.
No screaming guitars.
At least not until Goodbye to Love.
This is at a time that comes, you know, right after Turbulent 60s and all that music, and then the 70s with disco.
Yeah.
And they are not that at all.
They're definitely not any of those things. As I read about in the book, Karen flirts with disco when she kind of strikes out on her own. But for the most part, I think what the Carpenters were doing is a kind of an homage to the Great American Songbook, and a Great American Songbook that began to include acts like the Beach Boys and the Beatles. They covered Ticket to Ride on their first album, and the Beach Boys' harmonic sound was certainly very much an inspiration to the Carpenters' own. But, you know, as actually, I can't remember who exactly said it, what, you know, it may have been Richard's songwriting partner, John Bettis, who said it, that a lot of people in, especially in the early 70s, in the wake of the 60s, were trying to be people who they weren't, especially white kids, right? They were trying to harness, you know, the countercultural, even if they came from these middle-class white backgrounds. But the Carpenters themselves, they were suburban kids. They dressed like it. They looked like it. They sang like it. And they're sort of, they were kind of unapologetic and almost presented themselves naively as just that, you know. They're very honest in their presentation, in other words.
So for you, as someone who is not that.
Although I did grow up mostly in Southern California after the age of 10.
Okay. But
so I'm a Southern Californian.
You are, yeah. You are. Okay. But in general, well, you're not white.
Yes, definitely not.
And
although I don't know if anybody can hear that out there.
But what is it that made you, how did you relate to them in that on that level? Or did you relate to them on a different level?
I think that there were just different layers of that. I think that first and foremost, it was impossible for me to not relate to them, given that I was named after Karen Carpenter. There's an overdetermined relationship that happens when you have a namesake in that way. The other aspect of it is that I think, especially as Filipinos in the Philippines, when I was growing up there as a small kid, you know, we think about and look to America as a certain place that we know we have a deep and profound and sometimes complicated relationship to. And I know that this sounds a bit, you know, precocious of me to be thinking about this. It was all unconscious before the age of 10 when I moved here. But, you know, there's something about what the Carpenters sang about and represented that was this vision of America that was certainly had been peddled to us in other aspects of popular culture as post-colonial people in relation to the U.S. And so I think that, you know, in many respects, they were kind of exemplars presenting this ideal. When I moved to this country, I asked my parents, and this was the first time I ever came to the U.S., why my hair hadn't turned blonde yet. Because I just thought it automatically happened to you. But that whiteness was essential to, you know, being in the United States in some way. I kind of intuitively felt that. And I think that the Carpenters were part of that. And the songs that they sang about, which look back at these kind of halcyonic moments of Americana, are very much, you know, part of crafting that ideal of America in other places and in kind of places where the U.S. had post-colonial effects.
But instead of rebelling against that because you realize, well, oh, I see, my hair isn't turning blonde. This isn't the truth. There's a lot of misconception and a lot of, I don't know, fantasy involved here. You embrace it. You really like the music.
Yeah.
And you really find a complexity and a pathos to Karen Carpenter.
Well, I think that one of the funny things that happened is once I finally got here, and that was in 1983, so it was right after Karen Carpenter died, right? But the Carpenters' music hadn't been in vogue for a long time. So the fact that I knew this music and thought it was American music when other kids my age and other people I was around definitely disavowed the Carpenters' music made me associate the Carpenters with the Philippines. So I think that it wasn't just like this kind of identification with whiteness that was happening in my affection for them, but that in a way they became more emblematic of the Philippines to me and my experiences there as a small child hearing them in the 70s. than, you know, a lot of other things, because, you know, it was also kind of not well received for liking to listen to their music at that moment in the 80s.
Huh. So, but it was more than nostalgia.
It was, I think it's certainly more than nostalgia. I think that, I mean, I have an attachment to the her voice and the way it sounds. So there's all those other ephemeral things. I mean, I can intellectualize all the other stuff, but fundamentally, I think there's something really deeply affecting about her singing.
Yeah, and it's interesting that she's got this low voice, she's playing the drums, she's embodying a supposedly a feminine female ideal, and yet she's not in so many ways. And you talk a lot about queer culture and how there might be some kind of interesting overlap between that and your identity as a queer woman and Karen Carpenter.
Yeah. I mean, I think that one of the things that one comes to learn about Karen Carpenter, the more you look into her background, and also if you just kind of look more closely at their TV specials and things, is that Karen Carpenter was a tomboy. And she was a kind of tomboy from youth into the time that she was recording with the Carpenters. She was a drummer, which was super unusual, and which struck people as a bit of gender trouble when they saw it. Even at the height of their popularity, Johnny Carson asked her, you know, like, it's kind of unusual, right, to be behind the drums there as a girl and stuff. And she'd get asked that question all the time. Eventually, she had to move out in front because people wanted to see her as the lead singer. But, you know, my sense of that kind of physicality that she brought to her drum playing, and even in the sketches that she did with Richard on their TV specials, when she would be playing the drums, you know, gave me a place to understand that it's possible to, you know, I don't know, experience joy and be out there in front of the world even when you're doing things that aren't expected of your gender and that people question you about.
But she had such a tragic ending, and she died of a stereotypical female disease, anorexia, or complications related to anorexia.
Yeah, although one of the things that the book argues is that maybe we have to think about that apart from the kind of fear of the associations with, you know, like the beauty and femininity, but think about it instead as an attempt to maybe in her own way unsex her own body, because it's like one of their family friends talked about how when she saw Karen at the height of her struggles with the disease, you couldn't tell, quote unquote, you couldn't tell if she was a boy or a girl. Right. Or if it was a boy or a girl. And so I take that weird throwaway line in another conversation and kind of like think, well, what if this was about trying to shed those expectations of femininity, trying to no longer be just the pretty girl singer up in front, but to get back to that sort of unsexedness that comes when you are a drummer, a player, a musician, where you're not, you know, pinned to your femininity because you're up there representing the entire group with your voice and who you are and how you're moving. And so that's one of the bigger kind of speculations that I take in the book.
And for you, too, you talk about growing up in the Philippines and people not knowing if you were a boy or girl.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And that, you know, that can be a very painful set of experiences over a durational period of time. But at some point you begin to understand how it can be a strength, or that it allows you to understand yourself in a more complicated way than what people expect of you.
Okay. And the Carpenters are still popular today in the Philippines?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, I challenge anyone to step off the plane and go several hours without hearing them on the radio, in a car, in a bar. It's, you know, the ubiquity of their music there, along with other music from that era, too, I would have to say. It's stunning. And you know, I would argue, I don't have any stats to prove it, but they're the most popular there than they are anywhere in the world.
Did they know that at the time?
I mean, I'm assuming that they had a sense of that. I think that, you know, I know that they knew they were popular in Japan. They were popular in other parts of Asia. But Richard Carpenter went back there in 2009, probably has gone back since. I didn't really check on that. But like, he had a real big visit there. And, you know, he visited the sitting president. He was received like a true, you know, honorable emissary from the United States. And so I'm assuming that he must know.
Amazing.
That. Yeah.
How do you explain this adoration for the Carpenters?
I think it's very much tied to some of the things I talked about. You know, I think that there is at once there's the kind of historical relationship that you can flesh out between the U.S. and the Philippines, one that's kind of fraught because it's a colonial one. There is also the kind of the earnestness and sincerity with which we kind of accept Karen's voice and vocality is, you know, is in the wheelhouse of the kind of sentimental balladry that is so popular in the Philippines. And you know, I think that there are also other reasons, like, you know, that have to do with radio and armed forces radio being something that was so ubiquitous in the Philippines, you know, post World War II, essentially. And that, you know, just this music ensconced itself in people's hearts.
Well, Karen Tongson, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure to have you in here.
Well, thank you for having me here and chatting with me and for reading the book as a True Carpenters fan.
As a True Carpenters fan. The book is called Why Karen Carpenter Matters by Karen Tongson.
Such a feeling's coming over me. There is wonder in most everything I see. Not a cloud in the sky. Got the sun in my eyes. And I won't be surprised if it's a dream.
Well, that's it for our special musical edition of Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great rest of your holiday weekend. I'll see you on Monday.
And the reason is clear. It's because you are here.